This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 22, for Thursday, August 27th, 2009. Let's make a deal. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
So after this, will Cash and Clunk, Cash for Clunkers finally die?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's never going to die. We're going to have Cash for Appliances in October.
Oh,
so
you're
it's
right.
Maybe Cash
that's
for something.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome.
Right. How about Cash for Votes?
How about ApplianceExtremist.com?
Well,
Toaster Man.
Our alternate site is. Never mind.
Okay. I'm getting.
Contact Lens Extremist.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to another edition of Out of Line After Hours, where we speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Nothing but the high octane truth, John.
Right.
With lots of opinion.
I'm drinking truth serum, so it makes me speak the truth.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, joining me as always, Peter DeLorenzo, Mr. Auto Extremist.
John,
Peter, always great having you here on Thursday.
Great to be here. Great to be alive again.
Yeah. And David Welch from Business Week. David, great
here,
having
John.
You
yeah.
back in here. And joining us via Skype from California, Jessica Caldwell from Edmunds.com. Jessica, great having you here.
Hi, good to be here.
And just in case anybody doesn't know more about Jessica, I got a little bit of your background. You're the manager of pricing and industry analysis at Edmunds. You also spent time at Subaru in product planning.
That's right.
And Mitsubishi in product strategy. What's the difference between product planning and product strategy?
I'd say it's pretty much the same thing. I think we have a little bit of semantics going on of what sounds better, planning and strategy.
And then you were at Toyota in dealership real estate.
Yeah, that was a short stint. It was a college internship type thing. It was a college job, I guess you can say, but got to see a lot of the Japanese automakers, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the news that went on this week. And Peter, we ought to start off with your rant and your website at autoextremist.com, where you really keyed in on four ways to turn a car company around, or four things that you got to do well. Starting with design, focused consistency, smart marketing, and memorable driving experience.
Yes, I did write that.
This isn't the Inquisition.
Yeah, no, I just, it was, okay, Cash for Clunkers is over. It's time to get down to the business of the business again. And, you know, for 8 months we've been talking about bailouts and bankruptcies and this and that and the deals. And I just said, hello, let's get back and focus on the business. And those are four key things that I think these car companies absolutely need to focus on to succeed. And some reader said, well, not all companies can be Porsche or BMW. That wasn't the point of the column at all. If you're in this business, you have to strive for excellence. If you don't, you're going to be left behind.
Hey, elaborate on this, because design, I totally get it. Focused, consistency, I get that. Smart marketing, absolutely. Talk about memorable driving experience.
Well, I think there's a fear. We've talked about it, that when this new touchy-feely, smiley car age, that we can just drive around in these electric bumper cars and it won't matter anymore. And I disagree. I really think that, the power of the freedom of mobility will always be there. There will always be an emotional connection with movement for us humans. I really believe that. And I think that driving experience cannot be ignored. I don't care how many smiley miles you get in your electric car, there has to be some sort of involvement that connects with you while you're driving it. Otherwise, if I was running a car company, that would be part of my fundamental philosophy. Absolutely.
Yeah. Even in the horse-drawn carriage days. In fact, even if you go into Amish communities, you can tell who's got the cool horse carriage and who's got the dumpy one.
Yeah.
It really counts.
And the design thing, it's going forward, where we all have this, there's going to be this growing shared technology underneath these vehicles. And the example I gave is the Volt and then the Converge concept. Horrid name, but a beautiful
car.
Coupe. And going forward with this technology, as we get to more efficiency and all that, design's even going to be more of the ultimate initial product differentiator for people. I mean, you know, I've sat in focus groups where people say, well, I want efficiency and I want, you know, value and I want quality. And then they go out and buy a Mustang, you know. So, you know, people spark to great design. You cannot force people to buy boring cars. I mean, a lot of people settle for that. But given the choice, they spark to something that catches their eye, that spark of design that draws them in initially. I think it's going to even be more crucial in the next decade.
Oh, it's almost cliche. I mean, everybody has pretty decent quality these days, even fuel economy. I mean, you can't say that domestic car companies don't have efficient vehicles. I mean, that's just fatuous. They may not have the reputation for it, but they have the efficient engines. You know, they've got pretty good quality. You got to find another, you know, another way to draw them in. I think brand is going to be incredibly important too, and that's where the domestic car companies obviously hurt. But building brands, really being consistent with your marketing. I mean, I think brand and design are really the two differentiators going forward the next decade.
Jessica, you were going to weigh in there a minute ago.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think I agree with what everything has been saying. I think the biggest purchase driver, when you ask people, it comes down to emotion. What moves you when you're at that dealership? And that's really what sells people on cars. So I think if you don't have that, you're not going to have the hugest of audiences or of sales. So whether it's a small car, whether it's a big car, it's got to move people. And I think that really differentiates between a car that sells well and a car that is great.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. And you know, I've driven a couple of electric cars that are actually fun to drive. I mean, that's the great thing about electrics, right?
Yeah,
instant torque,
yeah.
Man. They can get off the line. I've driven some other electric cars that, I mean, you may as well go to the golf course and drive a golf cart. That's how exciting it was.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll see the shakeout, these companies who really still pay attention to the driving experience. I think right now I'm hearing good things out of Ford that, well, yeah, we have the Fusion Hybrid, but we really want driving Fords to be, you know, fun and enjoyable. So that's encouraging to me that they're.
Well, this will be interesting as we see more, whether it's electric cars or EREVs like the Chevy Volt or plug-in hybrids, cars with bigger, heavier batteries. Because, you know, most companies know how to at least give you a decent driving experience in terms of balance and handling. With a heavy engine up front, a couple rows of seats, and a trunk or an empty space for storage in the back. Most of them have that licked, but you're getting totally different weight distribution with these big batteries in the middle of the car or elsewhere, and that's when you're going to see, again, you'll be able to differentiate yourself on handling and drive experience because it's different engineering. It's tougher to do that.
Well, actually,
that's a great point.
They can get a lower center of gravity and
right.
Center the weight. We should talk about the Fisker Karma driving around Monterey, and they're making all kinds of pronouncements about, you know, the mileage or how far they can go on the batteries. And boy, the electric battery people came out really strongly, you know, saying, okay, you got to be kidding me, you know, if you guys can deliver this, because they made a lot of promises.
Yeah, well, you know, they're making all kinds of claims. Nothing's been independently verified. They better deliver, because if and when we in the media get our hands on these cars to test drive them and report about them, if it's fallen way short of what these guys have been claiming, they're going to get crucified.
Yeah.
Well, we've seen that problem even with hybrids. You know, I remember when the hybrid Honda Accord came out, and I forget what it was rated at, but I want to say it was mid to high 20s, 27 rings a bell. And I remember I drove the thing for a week, and my mileage for the week was about 21, which is about the same exact thing I got with a regular Honda Accord. And I thought, this is a problem, fellas. I mean, you know, maybe I'm a lead foot, but I got the same mileage in a regular Accord that I did with the hybrid, and that's not going to cut it, charging somebody another $3,000 or $3,500.
Right.
And you move that to electric, where are you going to get this range? It depends greatly on the driver. You know, Jim Hall, who we had as a guest here a few weeks ago, was telling me that something like a Nissan Leaf that's you know, gets 100, or they say we'll get 100 miles of range in the city. He said on the highway, if you're just gunning on the highway, it could be 60. It could be, you know, as low as half that range. So it varies like that. Consumers get unhappy, and they want an explanation.
Well, aren't they saying the Fisker Karma is supposed to get 300 miles?
What?
Oh, yeah.
Not on batteries. It's a hybrid, though, right? I mean,
yeah, but
they can't be talking pure electric.
They're talking some extravagant numbers.
Well,
and that's why people were saying, oh, boy.
If only they were publicly traded, we could short their stock. So, David, what are you working on these days for the magazine? Any story or cover or something that you can talk about?
Well, if I was working on a cover, I couldn't tell you in advance.
Well, that's why I asked, that you can tell us about.
Well, let's see. I've been covering the whole drama with Opal really for the last couple of weeks.
And what a drama. I keep saying
really
I am so jealous of my German colleagues in the media because, man, they have the most fun auto industry to cover right now. What a soap opera.
Well, it is. And what you have is GM has been looking to sell this thing because Opel's a big cash burner, big money loser, and really has been for the past decade. They got it to break even briefly when Fritz Henderson was running it, and then it went back into losses again. And then with the global recession, it just got worse. So they don't have the cash to keep it going and restructure it themselves. So they go to sell part of this thing. They get sort of a decent offer from Magna, but there are fights over who's going to have ownership of the platforms, the technology, the engines,
patents.
The intellectual property. Yeah, exactly. And they're going back and forth on that. And then RHJ International
investment firm.
Yeah, they put in a bid that requires less debt from the German government, offers less, but also takes less of an ownership stake. I think Magna was 65% and RHGI was 50% ownership. Both would still control it. But the German government doesn't want anything to do with that because, you know, Magna is promising to preserve more jobs, although actually the guys at RHGI told me that they would preserve just as many jobs.
They made that very public because the media still continues to report that Magna would not close as many German plants or none.
My sources on several sides of this tell me that they would all cut 10,000, both of them would cut 10,000 jobs. But, you know, the RHGI sort of has this nasty private equity stigma, you know, that they're going to do some kind of strip and flip. The main thing the Germans don't like about it, I'm told, is that RHGI would basically come in, they'd get the financing, they'd restructure the company, they'd keep it for a while, and they'd sell it to somebody, but good chance it would be GM, and GM would get it back. Now,
which GM denies. GM has denied that it's interested in buying it back, which I do not believe for a second.
I don't either.
I think that is exactly what their plan is.
Well,
at a minimum, one of the things GM is worried about, one of the things that the board is questioning in this whole thing is, should we give up Opel and basically sort of reboot their whole European strategy and go with a much smaller Chevrolet brand? You know, the cars come in to Europe mostly from Korea or as CKD cars, you know, assembled more locally, but still mostly assembled in Asia, a lot lower cost, but these are smaller, cheaper cars. They position the brand lower than Opel, so you're talking about sort of starting from almost from scratch and just getting rid of Opel. Do you want to really sort of start all over again in Europe? That's been a really big question for GM, but, you know, the Germans, I'm told, see RHJ as sort of a tool for GM, that GM would eventually be able to buy this back.
Wait a minute. RHJ, the R in it is Ripplewood, right?
Sure.
Ripplewood is got who on it? Tom Stallcamp.
Stallcamp is there.
Ex-Chrysler guy. Isn't Dick Donnelly from General Motors
Dick
on
Donnelly
Ripplewood? Or is he on RHJ as well, or
I
just Ripplewood?
He
Kursky
I
used
think
he to be there, didn't he?
No, so. Kursky was with CenterPoint.
Right.
I heard Rudy Schlaese is
another GM guy. Used to run their international op. So I could see where the German government is going, oh, my God, RHJ is just a bunch of ex-GM guys, plus some others, but...
Well, Stallcamp's a Chrysler guy, but in any case, it's Detroit guys, and if they even suspect that they're going to sell it back. You know, the interesting thing here to me is that the German government has really painted themselves into a corner because they favored the Magna deal all along. They've only offered to finance a Magna acquisition.
I thought that changed this week. I thought that Angela Merkel said that they'd give money to RHJ, too.
I think she softened up on it. I don't think they've actually offered it.
Okay.
And I've talked to some people today who
You're much more on top of this
in
than
Germany,
I am.
And she had, you know, she got a lot of criticism from the press in Germany about being so rigid on the options for this thing. But to my knowledge, they haven't said, well, we'd also finance a deal with RHJI, and that's still up in the air. In fact, you know, the guys at RHJI are still not very confident that, that they're really going to have a real crack at buying a controlling stake in this. But, you know, Merkel has been, you know, she's got an election coming up September 27th.
Right.
So she's got to do something that saves a bunch of jobs in Germany and preserves Opel. But she's so, you know, vociferously backed the Magna deal that if she backs off and does anything else, she's going to look weak. She's got problems with this no matter what. And then you have GM's board, you know, when Fritz Henderson recommended the Magna deal, pending some changes and some explanations of the financing, you know, the board said, well, you know, let's look at all options. Let's look at letting it go insolvent. Let's look at keeping it.
Well, that was a huge deal.
I thought that was a huge deal.
Ed Whitaker. Cue the music.
Cue the music, Ben. Do you have that?
Well, it wasn't just Ed either, from what I hear. But still, yeah, I mean, you have a new board here that, you know, 7 of the 13 members are brand new. And even some of those who came over hadn't been on the board that long. So you got a new board that came in and said, wait a minute, why do we have to do this one deal? We can look at keeping it. We can look at other options. And, you know, I didn't see it as a big slap to Henderson.
Not a slap. Not necessarily a slap. But this is the first time in a big, big issue the board has rejected what management recommended to it. I mean, I can't remember the last time that happened at General Motors.
Right.
In this big of an issue. And it's a big issue.
It is. It's huge. I mean, you think about it. I mean, you know, that's even with sales down, Opel's looking to sell about 1.2 million cars in Europe this year. Now, the Chevy brand in Europe is about one-third of sales. And, you know, there's a theory out there that if GM sells this controlling stake in Opel to Magna, eventually they'll sort of walk away from it. And the real big importance here, it's not just sales volume. Opel is the what GM calls the homeroom, or it's the engineering center for the
midsize
and for the compact cars, like, you know, the Chevy Cruze that's coming out. And they do a lot of work on the subcompacts as well. Now, you know, there's a good point here to be made, and, you know, Jim Hall and I were talking about this, that the Cruze is coming out, so that platform work is pretty well baked, right? The Malibu's not that old. I mean, that platform is done, and it's being sold right now, so that's all good. And you could go to the GM Daewoo operation in Korea to get subcompacts. They already do that work. And all of this stuff is new, so GM could go quite a while on these platforms before they had to find a way to engineer it in-house if they decided to let Opel go away and go into the arms of Magna, and eventually they just sort of walked away from it. I think this board's playing their cards pretty well because they realize that Merkel's got the deadline. They got time. You know,
right.
This is one of these negotiations where time is actually finally on GM's side.
But there's one more critical piece in all this. Magna's tied up with the Russian investment bank Sberbank, mm-hmm. which is tied in with GAZ, the Gorky right. Auto Works, whose new chairman and CEO is now Bo Anderson, yep. the former head of purchasing for General Motors. And I'm telling you, all the guys down in the tubes downtown there are pissed off that he left the company. And there's no way in hell they want to hand over all the patents and intellectual property
Plus,
to him.
Plus, their dealings with the Russians haven't been really swell anyway.
Well, and think about it. I mean, if... And that's where the issue of the patents and intellectual property got so big because, you know, you've got Magna's partner as a bank that's tied in with GAZ. And, you know, if they control the intellectual property, then you've got a real issue where...
That's a huge issue.
Where Magna slash GAZ or, you know, Magna and their Russian partners can become a competitor to GM in Europe, it's, you know, Western Europe against Chevy, but also in Eastern Europe and Russia where Chevy is actually growing pretty well. And then eventually maybe in Asia and other markets around the world. I mean, it's a big deal. It's a lot of drama.
Hey, another big deal I think that we got to touch on, too. Jim Press leaving Chrysler, or the rumors getting out there. Nothing official has been announced, but it sure looks like before the year is out that Jim Press is going to be gone from Chrysler.
I thought they announced it.
I don't think they have.
No, it was reported in the news. You know, I had heard this the actual day they emerged from bankruptcy and they announced all the executive changes that Press was going to be gone.
It's not a surprise to me.
Well, look at it. His title was Deputy CEO and Advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm told, I don't think he has any direct reports in that role. So he didn't seem to be an integral piece of management. You know, Marchione's got 23 direct reports. He you know, that's the way he runs the shop. And the three guys with a lot of the responsibility are the three brand heads, Jeep, Dodge, and Chrysler. And you've got Mike Manley, Peter Fong, and Mike Iacovetti. And, you know, those are the three guys, and they report directly to Marchione. So, you know, what was Jim Press's role up to this point anyway right. and going forward?
I just feel kind of sorry for the guy in a way, though. I mean, here he had this illustrious career at Toyota, rose to the highest level any non-Japanese executive has ever risen in Toyota, made the board of directors, and then walked away from it all to go with, the barbarians at the gate called Cerberus.
Yeah, they had first moved Presto off to the side, remember, and he was out of operations, and he didn't like that.
That's right.
And then Cerberus came along and said, Jim, move away from there. And, they talked him into going. And, it was basically a disaster. He bumped heads with Nardelli from the moment he got there. And, it's an unfortunate way to finish out a career.
I agree. That's the shame that I see in it. This guy.
It was always going to be a tough assignment, too. I mean, selling cars for Toyota with a great brand name, consistent marketing, and really good product, and then going to Chrysler, which, Chrysler doesn't want to hear this, but they've got product issues. None of their cars are recommended by Consumer Reports. They don't do well in quality surveys. Market share has been trailing down. Big incentives, among the biggest, month in, month out. That's a real tough assignment to walk into when, you've had the wind at your back. I mean, I remember at the time it happened, I said, look, Phil Jackson can win the NBA title with Pippen and Jordan on the Bulls and Shaq and Kobe Bryant on the Lakers, but give him the New York Knicks, who at the time were, they're still bad, but they were just in one of the worst franchises in all of sports. I said, give him today's Knicks and let's see how he does. And it was sort of the same thing with Jim Press.
Yeah.
Give him this really tough assignment. Things aren't going well.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm sorry to see his career end like it's ending, because the guy's better than that.
Maybe he'll resurface again.
Maybe he will. If this was the old industry, that is the industry of a year and a half ago, I would agree. But, man, this industry is totally different now. And one of the reasons for that is the next topic that we got to talk about, which is cash for clunkers. And we got to bring Jessica more into the discussion on this one. But, Jessica, the big news I think that Edmunds really keyed in on is that the government got it all wrong in terms of which vehicles really sold well. And, they're all touting Toyota and the Corolla as the best thing. And you guys found out that's not the case at all. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, I think the way the government approached it, I think, was a bit misleading. Because if you actually look at some of their press releases and what they're saying that this is the number of applications submitted. And, I mean, for anyone who's looked at what you have to do in terms of the process of submitting the application, a lot of people, I'm guessing, maybe didn't do it right the first or second time, maybe even the third time. So we're not sure, is this number that we're looking at in terms of Corolla selling well, in terms of Civic selling well, is this to do with applications or were these to do with actual car purchases? Because I think the number that they're saying and that I think a lot of people in the press are running with may be two different things. In my mind, I don't think application submitted is the same thing as actual sales. And I think that's where the problem starts to begin and starts to get a bit fuzzy.
So when will we know? I mean, are we going to have to wait a couple of months until the Polk data comes out or what?
Well, we're looking at it. I mean, obviously, we track transaction data. So we're looking at what's happening at the dealerships. We're looking to see, what's really selling. I don't think there's anything to stop necessarily the government to track what has actually been sold, because obviously that's going to happen in the transaction data. We're just not sure if they're choosing to do that. It just seems as if this is, they're choosing their words carefully. Is this an application? Is this a transaction? It doesn't seem to be very clear in terms of, what they're doing. So, I'm not sure if we'll ever get that from the government. I don't know if they plan on releasing it, or they could come back and say, the list we're giving you is the vehicles purchased, not the applications. But they haven't, they're kind of tight-lipped about a lot of the information that they've been giving. They've been putting it out there, but not answering a lot of the tough questions, I think, that are out there.
Well, one of the tough questions is that you guys have centered on is that if a vehicle has different powertrain options, it's counted separately. So a Ford Escape is counted separately for the all-wheel drive sales, separately for the front drive sales, and separately for the hybrid ones. Is that right?
Yeah, and I mean, we're not as 100% sure what the plan is or what they're trying to accomplish by that, but it just seems kind of silly. I mean, how is a Ford Escape two-wheel drive different than a four-wheel drive? I mean, they're really, you know, Ford Escape is a Ford Escape, and I think that's what
people report sales, they report the sales of the model. They don't break it down by powertrain. This is madness.
They don't, but what a dealer told me today, he thinks the reason for that is that when you actually fill out the paperwork for a clunker deal, you have to put down, you know, specifically whether it's a front drive, all-wheel drive, or, you know, whatever kind of powertrain for the vehicle that is sold through the deal. So the government just sort of takes this form and, you know, this line item on, a front-wheel drive Ford Escape goes in there, and then there's a separate line item for the all-wheel drive Ford Escape and on down the line, and they don't really have someone who's a statistician or an analyst aggregating this stuff. They just run a report. That's what he said.
But I don't care if that's the reason. That is the stupidest reason I've ever heard.
Well, I'm not saying it's a good one. It's a terrible one. The other thing is, hang on a second.
Yeah.
Now, the dealer that I was talking to also happened to, he used to be in the press office for the Reagan administration. So you know his political leanings. But he was theorizing, and I couldn't really argue with him, that they looked at this data, and it just happened to say that the top 10 cars are always the most efficient on the market. You know, they're all compacts and small SUVs, and I think the Prius was always on the list. So, you know, there was a green element to selling the Cash for Clunkers deal to the public, and certainly some of the Democrats on the West Coast who voted for it. So, you know, they're going to let this report fly if this guy's right, because,
Yeah, but another interesting thing about their list that I noticed too, so you had Ford Escape on there, and that was a two-wheel drive version. But if you actually looked at the last list the DOT issued, it also had Ford Focus two-wheel drive on, or four-wheel drive on there. And I wasn't under the impression that there was a Ford Focus all-wheel drive, and I don't know why it was just Ford products, that there was some sort of designation of what type of, you know, drivetrain it had. So that seemed a bit... you know, interesting too. I'm not 100% sure what was going on.
There is no Focus all-wheel drive.
There is no Focus all-wheel drive.
Isn't there a rear-wheel drive Bulldog edition?
Jessica, it's okay. You can say it's weird.
It's weird. I'm going to go there.
Strange.
Yeah, but why a Focus front-wheel drive but not a Corolla or a Civic front-wheel drive?
Okay, let's put on our conspiracy thinking caps here. One of the reasons for doing the Cash for Clunkers program was to show that everybody was going to buy fuel-efficient cars. So if you look at, what, the top 10 or so, they're all compact cars, right? Under the NHTSA numbers. But under your numbers, Jessica, what? The Escape was number one. Wasn't the F-150 fourth or fifth or something like that?
Yep, we had the Escape. We had the Ford F-150. We had the Chevy Silverado on our list. But, of course, you know, those may not be popular models for this program, or at least for the government to say, hey, people bought trucks, but that's the fact of the matter. I mean, if you look at what vehicles are being traded in, I can't imagine that everyone with the Ford F-150, a Jeep Grand Cherokee, you know, a Silverado, want to buy a Honda Fit or a Toyota Yaris. It's just not the, you know, it's just not the,
it's not logical.
Yeah.
And Jessica, if you look at the way the program was structured, it was a good deal for pickup owners and contractors to go and buy another pickup truck, because you didn't have to get one with great fuel economy to get the rebate. I mean, that's one thing I wrote when the program was initially approved, but before it was enacted, was that this thing was going to sell a lot of pickup trucks. It wasn't going to be a terrific green bill, but it would sell a lot of pickups and help Detroit because of the ease with which you could get a deal trading in a pickup for an older one for a new one. Is that the way you saw it?
Yeah, absolutely. When we were looking at some of the early definitions of what you can trade in, we were almost calling it trucks for bucks rather than cash for clunkers, because, you know, if you look at what the rules are, I mean, there's definitely a category of trucks where you only have to have a 1 mile per gallon improvement. I mean, how much saving the environment are we really going to do with 1 mile per gallon? So, but again, I guess another avenue was to stimulate car sales. They knew they had to throw trucks in there if that was going to happen. So I think it's just a case of a big compromise, really.
Well, you know, but here's the government's reporting that the Toyota Corolla was the best-selling car in Cash for Clunkers. It's all over the media. All of America believes that the Toyota Corolla was number one. In fact, on your list, because I got this up in front of me right now, the F-150 outsold the Corolla in the Cash for Clunkers program. And, you know, to me, it's just such... it's really puzzling how the numbers came out like they did and why the government published them as
well. Well, there's still politicians in Washington and California who want to believe that the pickup truck can be euthanized from American society, that no one actually works and no one actually uses pickup for work, and they could just be eliminated. And, you know, this manipulation, the statements, the PR spin, I mean, it's classic, you know, greening of this whole program. And the reality is, if you had an old truck, hell yes, it was a good deal. Go get a new.
It was easy to qualify, to bring in an old F-150 or Silverado, get a new one. You got the fuel economy bump, you qualified easily.
Look, the green part of this was always a bit silly because, now, from a greenhouse gas standpoint, you got to get better fuel economy. So if you're worried about global warming, making sure that there's some sort of bump in fuel economy is the way to go. But just getting some of these older cars off the road, regardless of what their fuel economy rating is, you're going to get better mileage because a car that – a friend of mine has a 93 Ford Probe that's rated at 20 mpg, so he couldn't trade it in on the clunkers deal. And he said, you know when the last time this car got 20 mpg is? You know, when these cars get older, they're not tuned. They don't get the miles per gallon. They've got old catalytic converters on them. So, you know, the air quality – and this isn't greenhouse gas, but this is smog and everything else, just regular old pollutants. That's dirty air. I mean, you're just getting old iron off the road – is better for the environment because, you know, they're not as efficient as they're rated and they're dirtier cars.
Hey, Jessica, where can our viewers and listeners go to see all your work on this?
Well, we're going to have more in depth, obviously, as the program closes. We'll have more numbers coming out next week. But I think if you go onto our site, our sister site, especially autoobserver.com, even Edmunds, look through our press releases, we kind of have some of the studies out there. Obviously, we're actually looking at transactional applications, so it could be different. But again, I think once things kind of shake out a little bit more and our data comes in a little bit more, we're going to be able to provide, a really in-depth kind of, report card or, what went right, what went wrong to see what actually happened, because I think a lot of people are curious. I mean, it's our money. All of us are taxpayers, so we want to make sure money is well spent.
To me, this is a bombshell. Has the media picked up much on what you guys have reported?
Yeah, definitely so. Obviously, we've been taking a lot of calls. I think any story in which you dispute with or have any differences with the government definitely takes an uptick in media exposure and interest, of course. So, yeah, we've been taking a lot of calls and a lot of customers, too. I think this program, it was really confusing. I don't know if you guys read the rules, but, 166 pages of rules and regulations just to trade in your car and get a new one. It was pretty tough. So I can see the dealer confusion, too, of submitting your application and not getting it right, getting it bounced back, submitting it again, because it was tough, really tough.
Oh, look, I had dealers tell me it took an hour to input the information. And if you got one little thing wrong, it would kick it back. And now you had to start all over again. So an hour just to submit one thing, that's like,
A dealer in Fort Worth told me, and this is actually a good thing, though, but that an inspector from, I think, NHTSA came out and looked at the contracts, made sure that the clunker being traded in had been owned by a year. Or for a year by the person trading it in, and actually, I think took pictures of the cars to make sure that the deals were all legit. So, they did check to make sure this went down right, which,
Oh, yeah, but I had other dealers tell me that they had to chase deals that here somebody came in, the car was registered under someone else, under this person's name, but then they got divorced and their name changed and then they had to get the divorce papers. And it was crazy. And one person who owned a car but didn't have it insured for 6 months, it had to be not just continuous ownership for a year, it had to be continuous insurance for a year. They lost the sale because it had not been insured for a few months. So there's some... some real government stickling kind of details in getting it all done.
Yeah, absolutely. We even had somebody write to us that said they had gotten married and they had changed their name and they got denied because the name was different on the different documents. And that, under the spirit of the law, I don't think is very good. And I think we're going to try to help some of these consumers. I mean, do what we can. Because I think there's cases out there where you can argue that this is not what this program intended. It didn't intend that if you got married and changed your name that you couldn't participate. I mean, I think that's kind of absurd.
Yeah, no kidding. So what happens now, Jessica? A lot of people are saying car sales are going to crash. But other dealers have told me, no. I mean, we've never seen these people before, these customers who came in to take advantage of cash for clunkers. I had numerous dealers tell me that these were people who typically never buy a new car or only come into the new car market every 10 to 15 years. So are we going to see – do you agree with that? And what do you think is going to happen to sales now?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of different cases. I think it probably stole some from the used market, some private party transactions, and Joe's Corner, you know, dealership lot who may have seen these people. But what we're looking at is prices. Obviously, we're Edmunds.com, so that's kind of what we do. And we've seen prices, they're going up. Dealer profit margins are definitely going up. If the inventory situation stays low, then I think prices will continue to rise. And I think, unfortunately, for a consumer who's coming in that just wants to buy a new car, had nothing to do with the Conquer program, I mean, they're paying the price. They're getting hit once with their tax money spent on this program, and two, you know, September is a big car buying month, 2009 model year sell down. And I guess one can argue there might not be a lot of inventory for people to purchase. So if you were waiting for that moment to get your great deal, you're not going to get it this year. And I think that's, you know, it's a bit unfortunate for people that had their hopes that maybe a few months ago that not everyone, you know, we all know all about cash for clunkers and salt coming, but I don't think that's the case for everyone.
Well, we've talked about this, that, you know, all these manufacturers have their costs finally aligned and they've jettisoned a lot of their debt, and they've gotten smarter about their production capacity, speed, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the days of the super deals are rapidly coming to a close, and I think they're going to get more profit per car, and the American consumer is better get used to a big rebate might be $500, not $4,500 in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, well, think about it. You know, Detroit got caught in this trap in the last 10 years where if you laid anybody off, they went in the jobs bank where you had to pay them damn near their full pay anyway. So the whole theory was, if we're going to pay them, let's have them make cars. So you made cars even if the market didn't want it. You incentivized the hell out of it. Guess what? That's all gone now.
Yeah.
That ain't going to happen anymore. So I totally agree, Peter. So 500 bucks might be a good deal going forward.
So are the 3 and 6 month contracts to the rental car companies that pushed a lot of cars out of the plants too. I mean,
well, you know, that was in a rental car. I forget. It was, you know, now the rental cars used to be 8,000, 9,000. Now they're 24,000, 19,000.
Right.
The days of the relatively new rental cars are over too.
And they're usually not very clean either.
Yeah. So Jessica, you know, we've been running at, you know, before the whole cash for clunkers thing. If I remember right off the top of my head, you know, May, June, 800, 850,000 sales a month for the U.S. market. I'm sure we're going to be over a million for this month, you know, of August. But going forward, September, October, November, do you think it'll settle down to the 800, 850,000 number, or is it going to go below that?
Mm-hmm. You know, John, I think it's kind of funny because, I mean, gosh, forecasting August was definitely hard. And I think September is going to be hard, too, at least in the short term, because I think there's a lot of questions about, you know, when is a sale? Because I think the inventory situation with manufacturers and dealers, and some manufacturers we've spoken to said that they're counting sales right when the vehicle is being shipped. So not necessarily when the customer buys it, but when it's sold to the dealer. So I think because the cash for clunkers created such a disruption in the marketplace, I think when the timing in terms of when a sale actually occurs is going to be fuzzy, because there may be stuff in August that's going to be counted in September and maybe vice versa. But I think the more long-term picture, if, you know, really prices start to rise, I think we could be back to a situation we were a few months ago with low numbers. August, or October rather, and November are seasonality, from a seasonality standpoint, a bad time. So I think those could be some pretty slow months.
You know, in Europe, they're really worried now about their cash for clunkers, or the scrappage scheme, as they call it, coming to an end. Germany put far more money into its program than we did. They put $7 billion into their program in a country that's, you know, what, not even half the population of the United States.
Well, their sales were up 30% a month, almost every month from like March to July or something like that. I mean, they got a huge pop out of it. But I wonder what kind of hangover they're going to have after this deal.
Well, now Ford Motor Company, you know, this was in the journal today, is lobbying European governments to say, let's not go cold turkey here. And a couple of months ago, Carlos Ghosn, you know, the head of Renault, was saying the same thing. Let's not go cold turkey here, because they're really worried that things will come to a crashing end. And I know in Germany the money runs out at the end of next month.
Well, I think we actually underspent on ours. I mean, $3 billion isn't a lot of money, and you look at it and you're talking about less than a 3% increase in sales based on, you know, roughly 10 million SARS every month so far this year, you know, ballpark, you're less than a 3% pop. We probably could have done a bit more, because I think what's going to happen here, there's going to be some sort of payback from this. I don't know how big it's going to be, because I've talked to a bunch of analysts I respect, including Ed Edmonds and, you know, and read Jeremy Anwell's statements on it, and he thinks there'll be some payback, and some think there'll be a lot, some think a little, there'll be some, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then once that works its way through, we're still going to be in the same lousy car market with the same lousy economy with poor fundamentals, and, you know, at the end of the day, it's not going to be a very big...
No, David, don't you read the paper? The recession's over.
Well, I think we may have hit bottom in the recession, but... That doesn't mean there's a bounce. I mean, you sort of look at this as if you're dribbling a basketball. Instead of a basketball, you have one of those, like, weight balls in the gym. Pfft. It may have hit the floor, but it's not coming back up yet.
It's going to take a while.
Yeah. Mm.
Jessica, what do you think going forward here? A lot of people are saying, oh, you just wait a year from now. There's going to be so many repossessions. There's going to be so much buyer remorse. What's your take on it?
I think there is some buyer remorse. Actually, from what we've been hearing, we talked to a lot of dealers. Obviously, I personally have talked to so many about Cash for Clunkers, and a lot of people are paying in cash. So I don't know so much about the repossessions. I'm sure it could happen, in terms of the people not being able to afford their clunker. But there was a surprisingly, considering that we're a debt country, surprisingly a lot of cash purchasers. So I think that's an interesting element that maybe we didn't see, because we're definitely all guilty, I think, of saying, oh, before the program started, who are these deadbeats coming in with 10-year-old cars? They're not going to be able to get financing. But they've come in with checks, and I think that's definitely an interesting and surprising element of this program.
I know C&W Marketing, Art Spinella, put out a thing today saying that in a typical market, you get about 8% buyer's remorse. That is 8% of the people who buy a new car, a month or two later go, what the hell did I ever do that for? But now he's saying it's twice that, like 17%.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, because I think what the clunker frenzy was that people were at the dealership. They wanted a clunker. They thought the money was running out. I think some people made some split-second decisions about what they wanted to buy. It may not have been their first choice. They might not have done any pricing research on it. They just bought it because they thought that the time was going to run out. And I know, and I've spoken to even people that are very smart consumers that have fallen into that trap. So I think a few months down the road, people might be sitting there thinking, what did I buy? Why did I do this? Especially those people that had larger vehicles and went to a smaller vehicle. But I think it was just, we all got caught up in that frenzy there for a few weeks, and it's a lot of people.
We ought to get our questions for rapid fire out here. But I want to pick up on what you just said. That's very interesting. Buyer's remorse of somebody who came out of a big vehicle, is in a small car, and is now going, you know what, I really don't like that. Aren't we going to see a lot of this going forward? Not just for cash for clunkers, but because of the way fuel economy laws are going to force this market to be selling a lot more small cars.
Yeah, I think so. I think smaller cars, whether we like it or not, they're going to be forced upon us, whether it's through legislation or whether it's through, manufacturers' incentives, what have you. I think that's something that we're going to deal with. We may not like it, and it won't be certainly for everyone, but I think, small cars are not going away.
Americans don't really like small cars, though. I mean, you have to give an economic incentive like a cash for clunkers deal or a big spike in gas prices. I had Experian Automotive pull me a bunch of registration data, and, the market last summer when gas peaked in, I think, late May at $3.76 a gallon, that's when compact car market share went up to 17% of the market. And then even before gas prices fell, it went back down to 11 or 12%. And what was interesting is that you had sort of this panic bunch of, buyers who went in when gas got to 376 or, above 350, trading in big vehicles for a compact. But then even as gas kept rising to 409, once the shock wore off, it trended back down again, and people sort of, I think the smarter consumers who did more research realized you don't save that much in fuel by trading in, say, a midsize crossover SUV or a midsize sedan for a compact. Well, let's face it, you can, some of the midsize family cars that have better engine technology these days, you can get 26 or 28 mpg versus 31 in a compact, but so much more space and usability, and it's a better car for your image and that sort of thing. There's not a lot in a compact car, you know, to really get you to come back and buy the thing.
Yeah, well, you know, think about it. You know, most people trading out of, let's say, a midsize SUV into a compact car are only, at least at today's prices, or even back when it was a little bit more expensive, going to save several hundred dollars a year. And you're going to go out and spend thousands, many more thousands of dollars to buy a new subcompact to save a couple of hundred a year. You know, it doesn't make sense.
Last summer,
economic sense.
When fuel prices really took that big jump, dealers were telling about people coming in with Tahoes and Escalades and trading them.
No, getting hosed. I mean,
just getting killed on the trade-in of the vehicle.
Yeah, you know, like losing.
To get something that's going to save them, you know, maybe, you know, if you went from an Escalade to like a Chevy Aveo.
Oh, the hysteria last summer was just, a year ago, was nuts. I mean, literally walking away and leaving $15,000 on the table and then, you know, come on. People just panicked.
I mean, well, look at it this way, because I was just pulling some of these numbers. You go to fueleconomy.gov, and at today's gas prices of $2.63 a gallon, if you buy a hybrid Toyota Camry, that versus the four-cylinder Camry will save you less than $400 a year in fuel. But the premium is either $3,000 or $3,500. So do the math. You got to own the thing for, you know, 7-8 years to break even. Mm-hmm. And people are doing that math and saying, okay, do I want a compact? Do I want a hybrid? And that's why, you know, we had Nancy Gioia from Ford, you know, Ford's hybrid program here last week. And she said, yeah, hybrids are 2.5% of the market when gas is cheap and, you know, 3.5% when it got expensive. And, you know, compact cars the same way. You know, another interesting fact I saw about this is that, you know, the top-selling compact cars in the segment, and, you got Civic is obviously always up there, but the best sellers aren't necessarily the most efficient in the segment. So it's not pure fuel economy that people buy them for either. So
I mean, for most people, good fuel economy is a bonus to having a nice car. You know, but first comes having, it gets back to what Peter said. You got to have a good driving experience. What? You know, and a good example of that is the new Honda Insight. I drove it, got terrific fuel economy, low 40s. You can have the car. Yeah. I mean, it's just surprisingly for Honda, because they've got so much respect for Honda. But not a fun car to drive.
Much more fun driving a Fit.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. Fit's a cool car. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Go ahead, Jessica.
We also noticed that's a lot about perception. I think some of the subcompact cars, whether they get good fuel economy or not, I think Smart is a good example. People just have this perception that small must get great fuel economy. All right, I'll buy it, without really doing, you know, a lot of the research, especially, you know, some of the comparisons and making that decision just like that, which I think is, you know, a bit unfortunate and a bit impulsive. So
yeah, because the Smart doesn't get all that good of miles compared to what else you can get.
No.
Yeah, definitely.
For such a small car, I mean, what's it rated at? 36 miles to the gallon. You know, I think the Focus is, well, on the highway, rated at like 34, you know, and I'm not trying to compare those two cars. I'm just saying the Focus is like three times the size of the Smart.
Well, if you're shopping fuel economy, it's clearly diminishing returns once you get to a certain point. And, you know, it differs for everybody, but I'd say it's probably, you know, 27, 28 mpg, you know, then what you're giving up in space and everything else, it's just not worth it, you know, to get another couple miles per gallon. What's that really going to save you per year in fuel? It's not much.
Hey, I see Chip with the list. It's time for rapid fire. Ben, let's roll it.
Still say that looks like Tom Cruise with a Rambo getup.
Okay, John Wills asks, and this is the different John Wills than the guy who's monitoring the site. He says, can you comment on whether or not the European scrappage program had more or less government hiccups than ours? Jessica, do you know much about the European scrappage program? Did they go more smoothly than us?
Yeah, I think we definitely looked into it. I think there were a lot less rules, of course. I mean, our government having rules? No way. But I think they had a lot less requirements, restrictions. They weren't quite as meticulous about some of the rules. An interesting thing I did hear, actually, coming out of that scrappage program was that they weren't very specific in terms of what happens to the car afterwards. And a lot of those vehicles have ended up in the third world, North Africa, those type of places, which, I mean, if you're going for a scrappage program, I don't think it's going to be successful if it just ends up someplace else. So that was definitely, I think, not hitting the right target there.
But I think they were going more for pure economic stimulus than scrappage. I think that was more their intent, more what they wanted to. They wanted to get more of a sales pop out of it than just taking old cars off the road.
Okay, here's a video one that we have. Actually, not a video, but John, J-O-N, asks, with all the talk of the vet commercials, it made me think of this one. I saw it the one time it aired before it was banned. I loved it. Let's play that video.
I don't have that, John.
Oh, you don't have it? Okay. No problem. So Phil asks, how's the American designed and built Toyota Venza doing? It was drawing a lot of attention at the Toronto Auto Show this past February, but I don't see many on the road. Is it a hit or a flop or somewhere in between?
You know, I haven't looked at the numbers of it lately, but you could probably pull them up there. I haven't seen a ton of them on the road myself.
Jessica, how's the Venza doing? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, for Toyota, I don't think it's setting the world on fire, which they don't like. But it's doing fairly okay, I'd say. I mean, it's hard to say. They launched a car in the middle of a recession that, you know, is a bit bulkier, kind of on the bland side. So from a sales perspective, it's doing okay, but I don't think it's setting any sales record anytime soon.
I'll say this about the Venza. I love the styling. I was knocked out when it debuted at the Detroit Auto Show, if I remember right.
It did.
I was knocked out by the styling. To me, it was like, oh, my God, this is a Lexus that says Toyota on it. But then when I drove the car, it just doesn't deliver. It's not as substantial a car as I really think that it should be. So I'm trying to call up the numbers here, and we'll get to that in a second. But next question. Drew Allen asks, why has the auto industry been so slow to adopt features in small cars like voice-controlled nav systems, remote start, and big car power seats?
I think Ford is probably trying to change that before the other ones. You know, they're really pushing that technology down into their product lineup. I don't know. I mean, you know, I think it's for the same reason that the industry ignored the small cars before, because they couldn't make money on them and they couldn't figure out how to make money on them. And with all these costs removed, now they can start really thinking about that.
Yeah, you're talking about a tough profit proposition, and then you just throw cost in. And if you can't get pricing for it, if the people buying those cars won't pay for Bluetooth and all that. By the way, it's not just Ford. I mean, you know, Kia is putting in I think standard satellite radio and a lot of...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was sort of thinking too. Domestic there. Yeah.
Hey, I've got the numbers here on the Venza. It's selling at about $5,000 a month, which is way ahead of the 4Runner, the FJ Cruiser, whose sales have literally collapsed. It's better than the RAV4. It's just a little bit behind the Tundra. So that's not bad. That's actually pretty good. It's doing better than I would have thought. But I get the sign now that we've got the video on that vet commercial. Let's run that now.
Is this one you worked on, Peter?
I don't know which one it is. Oh, yeah. No, I... They ran this quite a bit.
Did they really?
Yeah. Didn't run just once.
Which is a little kid in a Corvette zooming around, flying through the air with it, with other little kids, you know, sort of gaping in admiration and envy at him.
And this was banned?
This commercial was banned.
They pulled it.
Why?
Because safety groups...
Lots of hand-wringing.
Well, there was a bunch of safety groups that said, how dare they show a little kid driving a Corvette at speed?
Two kids. Jumping them. I mean, come on. It's just like this stuff going on.
Sensitivity.
The stuff going on in this country right now, boy, I'll tell you what.
Hey, we're just chicken.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, that's a more recent commercial too. I thought he was talking about something old.
No, it was only like 3 years ago.
Okay, Deuce Dowry asks: does anyone but me see any parallels between the Fiat Chrysler merger of today and the AMC Renault merger of the early '80s?
Yeah,
I hadn't thought of it that way.
There are some parallels. I actually worked on the AMC my first job in the business, I worked on that AMC Reno stuff. There are some parallels. I mean, I don't know what to say about Marchionne, except it's a giant wait and see for these guys.
Giant wait and see.
Giant wait and see because they've got basically nothing except for the Jeep Grand Cherokee and the Reskin 300 for the next 22 months. And I don't know what they're going to do in the interim.
Yeah, it is really tough. They just, the Germans didn't leave them with much, and Cerberus cut and cut as well, and not a lot of product coming. What are you going to do?
Yeah. Okay, Zoyal asks, how big of a challenge does Penske have in partnering with a manufacturer for the Saturn line, and who should he partner with?
I don't think it's a challenge at all. I think it's a done deal. I think he's got a deal with Carlos Ghosn, and they're going forward full speed ahead.
And source them out of Korea from Samsung,
yeah,
which Renault owns.
Right.
Well, nobody wants to doubt Penske because most of his business ventures have done really, really well.
Keyword is most.
Yeah.
Not all, but most, right. Jessica, what do you think? If you were Roger Penske, who would you go source cars from?
I mean, I think definitely the ones that we had mentioned are a good source. I think, those are smaller cars. It seems like they're more willing for a partnership. I don't see Toyota, Honda, ready to open their doors to him quite yet. So, I think that seemed like the safe and easy bet.
Okay. Mitch Weaver asked, did Rick Wagner get a fair shake with his pension? Remember, I think Rick was supposed to get like
22.5 million,
and they cut that down.
7.2.
Yeah, we should put this one to the American taxpayer. Yeah. I think they would have a quite a harsh opinion on this, but yeah.
Yeah, did he get a fair shake? No, but nobody in the industry is getting a fair shake these days.
You don't think he got a fair shake?
Well, I mean, look. Everybody dumped everything on Rick's lap. Rick's the guy who got fired for decades and decades and decades of sins by not just General Motors, but by their union and a whole bunch of others. And should he have been fired? Yeah, maybe he should have. But, like I said, Rick's getting blamed for a lot of stuff. Did he contribute to the problem? You bet he did. I mean, he was chairman of the company, after all. But, like I said, there was a lot of sins of other people have been dumped in his lap.
No, it's true, but at the same time, when it's taxpayers' dollars and when other constituents took a bath in bankruptcy, it's tough to give this guy a big payout, particularly when Americans are tired of seeing executives who've either caused the problems or at least failed to fix them walk away with big piles of money. He, in fairness to Rick, he probably also paid a price for the some of these banking executives who walked away with big pile of money.
Well, I think he did, and that's the unfair part of it.
That is, yeah.
Okay, Michael Weber asks, and this is probably perfect for you, Jessica, how much does a used car dealer mark up the cars? Is there a great big margin on financing for used cars?
Yeah, really, I think it really depends on the category, especially some of the more popular vehicles versus some of the large SUVs. But I think the used car market is struggling a bit right now. I think all the clunkers that could have gone into the used car market are now gone. And I think that's going to take a big hit. I think in a few years, with all the cutback on leasing, the used car market is going to take another hit. So used car prices, are pretty high. A lot of the financing, though, is either done through a third party, like a credit union or something to that effect. So it's not necessarily, I think this question might be alluding to those buy here, pay here, where it's strictly the dealer is making their profit on on the financing arrangement, but I don't think that's not always the mainstream way to do the used vehicle purchasing.
Well, before this upheaval, the sharper dealers would always tell you, yeah, we make a lot more money in our used car lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you can look that up. Look at any of the publicly traded car dealer chains,
yeah,
and their used car operations have much fatter margins.
But Jessica, I don't quite agree with you. I think the used car market is going to be red hot, at least from a profit standpoint, because there just isn't that many used cars going to be available going forward. And forget the cash for clunkers. I mean, we went from 17 million units new cars to 10 million. So that means next year there's 7 million fewer nearly new used cars in the market. I see prices doing nothing but going up. I keep joking that we ought to pool our credit cards and get into the used car business ourselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I definitely agree with you. Prices are going up because I think the supply has shrunk so rapidly. So I think some of the advice that we're telling people out there is look at a used versus a new, because sometimes the new car with some of the financing incentives you can get, because obviously they're more favorable when you actually look at the monthly payments, could be more favorable on the new car than the used car.
Okay, Jonathan Wills on Twitter asks, looking at the final C4C data, cash for clunkers data, GM is second in percent of market share, but has no vehicles in the top 10. And so he says, is that because of too many brands?
I think it goes back again to what exactly, you know, were they reporting? Because, I mean, honestly, that's the same question we have there. Are all the GM vehicles numbers 11, 12, 13, you know, just didn't quite make the top 10 list, or what exactly is going on? But I think that's the same nuances that we've been noticing with some of the data, which in turn got us to look a little closer at it.
Well, it's a good question, because when I looked at the Transportation Department's last set of data, trucks were more than one-third, I think. It was roughly one-third of the vehicles. But according to their data, none of them were in the top 10. So they're one in three of the vehicles that went through the program, but not one made the top 10. You know, that's what tells you something with the reporting was a bit amiss.
Here we got a comment that says, this show has totally sucked since Jason Vines left. Sincerely, Jason Vines. Hey, and we also have a phone-in question. Ben, why don't we get to that one?
Hey, just a comment about the death of V8s here in the market. You know, I think it'd be a great thing to mention on the show, you know, that if anybody thinks that they just might regret having an opportunity, now's the time to snatch up new and used V8 automobiles. Just bought an Audi with a 4.2 on purpose, and yeah, you know, the 11 miles a gallon is kind of stinging, but you know, it was like, hey, when am I going to get this chance again to really kind of experience and to have that? And for those gearheads out there, you know, this is kind of the first and last time you're going to have to be able to say, hey, I could have had a V8.
Yeah, I had a Corvette convertible a few weeks ago. Ain't nothing like a V8, man. So
I actually disagree that Cafe is going to kill off the V8.
No, they're not going to. It's not going to kill it.
I don't see it happening.
No.
I don't even think Cafe. I mean, look, you're going to see more small cars. You're going to see better fuel efficiency. But
I'll tell you what's going
to happen. Cafe's not going to get us to 35 mpg.
We're going to have high-performance cars. They're still going to be there. We're going to have 8-speed transmissions. They're going to be hyper overdrives. You'll be able to blister away from a stop, but overall mileage is going to go up. There's still a lot of efficiency left to be had from the internal combustion engine. I mean, we're going to have, you know, we're going to have great cars for a long, long time to come, and high performance cars too.
And I keep saying, we should start seeing cellulosic ethanol hit the market this year. Still in only pilot production, not mass production, and algae for fuel is coming as well. In fact, one guy that I keep watching, this guy Craig Venter, the guy who broke the human genome, is now into developing
algae.
You know, bioengineering algae for fuel. And if this stuff hits, we're all going to be driving V8s again in another decade. So, well, I think this is probably a good time to wrap up the show. But Jessica Caldwell from Edmunds.com, it's been great having you on this program.
Thanks, guys. Nice talking to you.
Yeah.
Take care, Jessica.
You take care, and we'll be talking to you in the future. Great information that you had there.
And I believe that Caldwell is a Scottish name. I think it's a Scotswoman.
Yes.
Well, thanks again, Jessica.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you guys, too, as always.
Always good to be here.
And we ought to get John Wills out here. Let's get him on camera before we completely go away. Do we have a mic for him? This is great having you here, man.
Thanks for having me on.
Saying your name so many times, and thank you for watching the chat room. It's great to have you here in person.
Yeah, me and Rumble Strip are always out there. So, yeah, it's nice to finally be here and see you guys. And I had a night off tonight. I really enjoyed being back in the studio, watching the guys put everything together while you guys are out here chatting it up. And it was another good show. So,
and we should remind everybody, too, you can find us at facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. It's great to find out all kinds of updates and everything that we're doing. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/autoline. Follow Peter at twitter.com/autoextremist.
Occasionally.
Follow David at twitter.com/dwelch47. That's D-W-E-L-C-H-47. Okay, chaps. Yeah, good.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Orange, purple, silver, and blue, change of